Could you put your hand up if you're a church leader in an urban area? If you're a minister of some kind in an urban area? If you're a theological college? If you're a caring professional in an urban context? If you work for a voluntary organisation of any kind? So we have already a massive experience here in the room about the urban context in which some of us work. What I'm going to do now is ask our panel to introduce themselves and to say a little bit about their work, and then we're going to open the session up to questions from the floor. Pip, would you like to go?
Hello. I was sat in my car outside a tube station in London waiting for my... Sorry. You don't need a microphone. Pip Wilson, yeah. Yeah, keep reminding me, so I'll keep saying it. Pip Wilson, yeah. I was sat in my car outside a tube station in London, and a young man and a young woman walked out in the late 20s, and my eyes caught them and held them. The young man was very agitated. His movements were almost uncoordinated. The young woman with him looked like she was on some form of addiction. The first thing he did was walk to the telephone and put his two fingers into the cash box. And my heart went out to him. I yearn very much for young people, male and female, Vicky Pollards. Vicky Pollard in our country is a bit of a joke. Have you heard of Vicky Pollard? No. And yet there is loads of people living in tough places, suffering from all sorts of things. And all my life, really, I've done that sort of thing, is work, especially with young people who are on the fringe. And that's what I do now, really. I do group work with young people who are in hostels or people who have addictions, people who have... And then I train the staff to do that sort of work. But I have this deep passion for the least, really.
Hi, my name is Amber, and I live in the United States in a city called Philadelphia on the East Coast. I live in a small Christian intentional community in North Kensington, which I noticed Kensington is all around London, so that was really fascinating. We took some pictures of that to take home to show everybody. Kensington is the poorest district in Pennsylvania, and 8 years ago, a group of college students got to know a group of homeless mothers and families that were squatting in an abandoned church building together. And through the relationships and new knowledge that they gained from becoming close friends with these moms with their kids who were homeless, our community was born. I've been in the community for about 4 years now, and our work kind of changes seasonally depending on the needs of the neighborhood and who exactly is living in the house at the time. We have a kind of core foundation of folks that have been there really long term, and then some folks that are kind of in and out. Primarily, we share food and clothing and things of that immediate nature with people. A lot of folks in the neighborhood bring clothes and get clothes, and so it's kind of a sharing place for folks in the neighborhood to take care of each other as well. We also do urban gardening with children, and we do theater camps during the summer and after-school program during the school year. The theater camps are a way for the children to learn more about collaboration with each other and to trust their inner selves and their creativity. Let's see what else. That's a lot of what we do, yeah. And a little bit of education as well with folks in more affluent areas sometimes come to stay with us, and we do kind of little mini schools with folks, church groups and student groups on poverty and apathy and militarism and economics and how all those things are interconnected.
Thank you. My name is Tani Umidi. I'm a pastor in Liverpool. Now, we planted a church in Anfield in 1991, and within a year, we were really confronted with the challenge, of the community where God had placed us. Kids on the street at night, and right in front of our church was where drugs were being dealt, and so many broken homes, lots of houses there, homes on with unemployed people in, and long-term sickness, you name it. The educational statistics for the schools in the area were awful. Three of the wards where we minister are actually in most indices you would look at, government indices, were one of the worst in the country. So these were the challenges that we faced as we began to minister in Anfield. And so God then began a process of challenging us to look at how we can engage with the community. And we run various programs. One of them, we run a supported accommodation for 16, 17-year-olds from the care sector that's been extremely successful, turning the lives of young people around. Also, we have a project called Liverpool Lighthouse, which is based in Anfield itself, which now does various things based around urban arts, using urban arts, hip-hop, rap, and various programs like that to engage with the wider community. You know, the young people, we run an alternative education program that's now funded by the LEA. We run various programs, Learn Direct Center and Incubation Unit for Small Businesses. Really, it's what we try to set up. It's a place where people can come in. If we can't help them, then we can signpost them. So there are roughly about 1,000 people that come into our facilities every week. And there's also a theater. So it's now a recognized performing arts venue. Also, on a wider city basis, we work with the Culture Company. We're very much engaged with the Culture Company in delivering the European City of Culture program in 2008. We're setting up 100 choirs right around the region leading up to a big festival on a main street in 2008. Choirs in schools and colleges and businesses and so on. And we use this. It's some of you that were here at the starting program yesterday would have seen the choir, Love and Joy Gospel Choir, on stage. That's our ministry choir. And so we've been very much involved in the whole move of God within the city. So that's what we do.
Hello, my name's Barbara Glasson. I'm a Methodist minister in Liverpool City Centre. And I work with a community, some of whom are right here, who gather each week to make bread together. And unlike Tani, we don't run any great programs or community projects. What we are is a simple presence of people gathering together, a very inclusive community, trying to balance the issues of inclusion and safety, understanding that for some people to be in an inclusive community is not a safe place, and trying to see people in their difference, engage with our own inclusive need to include ourselves and our struggles, and to be a place where people can have time and attention to be themselves, to be listened to, and to realize that we're not helped and helpers. We are human beings together gathering around our bread-making table. We make really good bread. We give it away. We enjoy it. We're all much rounder now than we were when we started. We understand that bread is not just a substance to eat. It's a means of engaging a community. We can look into each other's eyes and share the experience. But we can also be in solidarity with people who around the world make bread with their families and support their communities in many ways. It's a small place, a fragile place. And in that is its gospel strength. And we are proud to be there in this fragile and tentative way.
I'm Stephen Timms. I'm the MP for East Ham in East London. And when I was a student in a Christian union, we took part one summer for 2 weeks in a mission in the area of East London that I'm now the MP for, and effectively I've never left. I'm a member of the church that was planted by the mission group, and having moved into the area, which is a couple of years, properly moved in, a couple of years after the mission, I joined the Labour Party. I'd always been a kind of supporter of the Labour Party, but hadn't done anything about it. I didn't do any politics at all as a student. But I joined the Labour Party, became party secretary. That was the hat I first wore when I spoke at Greenbelt a very long time ago. Became a local councillor, became leader of the council. And then, 12 years ago, became the MP. In 1998, I became a minister, and in May of this year, I was appointed to the Cabinet as Chief Secretary to the Treasury, where my job is to manage public spending, and in particular, to take responsibility for the Comprehensive Spending Review, which will be published next summer, next July, setting out government spending plans for the coming 3 years. A review of the third sector is quite an important part of that review.
Hello, my name is Paul Keeble, and I've lived since the late 70s in inner city Manchester. It's not where I'm from originally. I'm a missionary from Northern Ireland. Okay, I'll just pause for in remembrance of that. About 10 years ago, I felt a call to work more where I lived, and the upshot of that was helping with another guy put together an organization called Urban Presence. We try and resource urban ministry, and we also try and see urban ministry recognized within the wider church, or urban areas recognized as a mission field. 4 years ago, in my area of Manchester, which is Longside, which is next to Moss Side. You've probably heard of Moss Side and heard of the problems there with gun crime, gang violence, etc. Well, that has spilled into Longside and other parts of Manchester. So it was something that we were concerned about because it was coming onto our doorstep. And someone organized a march called Gang Stop, just a local person. And a whole bunch of us went along to that. And then afterwards, there were a series of community meetings. And out of the community meetings came an organization called Charisma. Despite the name, it's not a Christian organization. It's a grassroots community organization. And a lot of my time in the last 3.5 years has been in helping that do its thing, really, which we're still trying to find out what it is exactly. There's a fair degree of urban chaos about it and making it up as you go along. Which I think is a sort of thing about urban ministry, full stop. Charisma is about advocacy for young people, to funders, to government, to local government, to media, representing local opinion. It's also about motivation, motivating people. Charisma is not about a few of us running ourselves ragged while everybody else watches. It's trying to get everyone else to get involved as well. That includes the churches. And Charisma is also about networking. Finding out what's going on already and trying to get everyone to cooperate together so we don't keep reinventing the wheel. We don't do projects as such, although we do organize a Peace Week every year, which is really a platform for anyone and everyone to get involved and do something relating to peace within the area, and it is as big as the number of people who get involved. And we also organize things like consultations for maybe an MP wants to find out what's going on and what people think so he can report back to his party or his bosses or whatever. Or the Home Office asked us to do a consultation on stop and search with young people. We've done a whole series of those. And really, it's still forming. It's a bit of a movement. It's a bit of a funding thing. It's a bit of a organization. We're not too sure what it is, but as I say, we're making it up as we go along, and it's a mixture of frustration and inspiration.
Introduce myself. My name's Paul Hackwood. I'm a trustee of the Church Urban Fund, which started 3 years or 4 years after Faith in the City, and has over the last 19 years given away £56 million in grants, has funded 4,500 community projects working locally, sometimes in churches, sometimes on their own in local communities, and works with about 300,000 people per year in social community projects across England. Let's open up to questions. Has anyone got a question for us? Please let there be a question.
I go to a church in central London, and it's in an area which is, it's not dominantly Muslim, but there's a significant Muslim population. And we're not a new church, but a whole bunch of people came along about 3 years ago, and we've been very much trying to learn how to do community work where we are. And we're still very much learning how to do that with the Muslim population. We have a children's club, which is seeing lots of local children, the Muslim population as well, come into that. But I'd be really interested to know how, in the various guises, you engage with communities of different faiths, and to what extent you seek to invite them into the services that you may have, in churches that you may have, and so forth. Thanks.
Anyone want to go for that one? Stephen?
In East Ham, I see the Vicar of East Ham is here, about a third of my constituents are Muslims, so this is a very big issue for me. And I think I'm rather biased, because the way I became the MP was that the previous MP died suddenly, and the person who rang me up to say that I should put my name forward for the candidacy was the chair of the Alliance of Newer Muslim Associations. And what he said to me was, well, you believe in God, we believe in God, we think you should go for this. And so I've had, until the last 3 or 4 years, a very good relationship with the local Muslim community. Things have been a bit trickier since, although being repaired. I mean, one thing that two things I'd say. First of all, I think we must avoid doing what the interfaith movement has rather tended to do, which is kind of pretend that really we all believe the same thing, because that's just not true, and everybody knows it's not true. And I think it's very important to avoid the dishonesty, which I think has marred some of what's been done in that direction, first of all. Secondly, however, I think there is a great deal of scope for very constructive working together on community issues, on values-based political approaches, and I think we should do a lot more to make the most of that and do it in an honest way. I mean, one thing that struck me over the summer was, at one stage, there were some criticisms in the papers about the fact that Muslims tended to regard themselves as Muslims first and British second. Well, I mean, my guess is probably most people in this tent regard themselves as Christians first before British. And, you know, I think there's a very important role that we can play as believers, and honestly play, given all that's going on at the moment. There's such an enormous amount at stake, and you could see that things could go terribly badly over the next year or two, or they could go in a very positive direction. And I think we've got a vital part to play in making sure it's the latter rather than the former.
This is a bit of a cheat, really, because Charisma isn't a Christian organisation, and we're just saying to absolutely everyone in the community, if you're concerned about peace and doing something for young people, get involved. We've seen a lot of individuals get involved from various faiths, especially during Peace Week and things. One problem we've had, though, is that a project we were asked to help facilitate was street pastors in Manchester, which is specifically Christian, which is gone very well and has attracted a lot of publicity. That has meant that a lot of people have thought, Charisma, they're all Christians. And we're just sort of trying to come out from under that at the moment a bit. Not that any of us are saying we're not Christians who are involved in Charisma. But as Stephen was saying, it isn't about just saying, it's all the same, really. But people from other faiths respect commitment, and we should respect commitment as well where we see it.
Supposed to answer questions, but I'm going to answer this one. I was a vicar in the centre of Bradford before I moved on to the job I do at the moment and became a CUF trustee. And I think there are probably three levels at which the relationship between Christian communities and Muslim communities can go on. And I categorise them as welcome, hospitality and love. So there is the welcome, where we're open to the possibility of meeting with other people, engaging with them and talking about things, but largely on our own terms. There's the hospitality, which is about adapting ourselves a little bit to the things that are coming in from outside. So in our community cafe, we decided that we would start to have halal food, so that invited in members of the Muslim community. So that was a little bit more than welcome. We were moving to hospitality. But then after a while, we started to get into relationship, and there was a movement backwards and forwards, listening to what the Muslim community could teach us about faith. And we learnt a lot about prayer from our Muslim brothers and sisters, and listening, being able to speak authentically to them about the sorts of issues that arose for us. So I think that that relationship can go on at different levels, but what we're aiming for is the authentic Christian response to a relationship with people who have a different view of the world, and for that to be an encounter that moves us both on. And I think there is a real possibility of that sort of work happening as we engage with the Muslim community.
Relating to that, how much of a problem do you consider it to be that the majority of immigrants tend, naturally enough, to want to stay within communities of their own kind rather than integrating across other communities and dispersing more?
I mean, I think it's always been like that in East London. I mean, there's that famous building in Brick Lane where, first of all, the Huguenot used it for a chapel, Protestant chapel. Then the Jewish community used it as a synagogue, and now it's used as a mosque by the Bangladeshi community. I mean, I think people always will want, when they first arrive, to be with others that they identify with. But it's important that we go beyond that, and I think that's the significance of what Ruth Kelly's been talking about this week, the Commission on Integration, about looking at how we can do that better than we've been doing it up to now. So I think there are some challenges there, but I don't think it would be right to criticise people or complain about the fact that, to begin with, people will want to be in communities with people who are very like them.
If I can also respond to that, I think that we also not only have communities that stay together, but we have isolated people that arrive on the back of a lorry, on their own somehow, without families, very isolated, turning up often into the middle of a city. And there's a sense of being alert and aware of people that have no basis of community. I think we're in a different, in Liverpool, I think we're in a different place as far as asylum seekers are concerned. Very isolated often, invisible, living on people's floors and so on. And also sometimes struggling with their own faith community. So, for instance, there's a member of our church who's a gay Muslim asylum seeker who can't worship in his Muslim community but wants to say his prayers. And for us to have that conversation with him, how we can be together and find a way into prayer, is a challenge and a growing point, not just for us, but for him too. And it can be a really creative but a hard place to be, but worth working at.
Any other questions?
Sorry, can I respond to that? Yes, I was going to say that perhaps the challenge we have, even deeper still, is to look at our congregations and what they represent. Because it's not just about where people stay, it's about what we say as Christians, even in our worship. And so that's one of the challenges we've faced as a church in Liverpool, and we do have lots of asylum seekers of different cultures and religions that come onto our premises and use our facilities, and we make no apologies about it at all that we're Christians, and in fact, if anything, they respect us. I mean, for instance, I've had challenges from Muslims about how Christians treat their Bibles. And they've been stunned to see Christians throwing their Bibles around. And they said, "What? Don't you respect your holy book?" You know, so these are some of the challenges that we can receive from welcoming others. And also, of course, I mean, it's an opportunity to explore faith. But I would say that above all, what we have as Christians is the love of God. And that love should know no bounds. And it's an unconditional love. And if we operate from that perspective, then it would not really matter whether it's an old woman on the street that needs help, or an asylum seeker, or a young person. You know, the love of Christ would seek to reach them in exactly the same way, meeting their different needs. And I think as churches, perhaps that's the challenge that we face as churches. Okay.
I think we do this very sort of thing, meaning we, there's quite a difference of us here, but there's mainly people of a white skin. And what we do is we gather together. I know so many places they recruit staff and they employ them similar age to what they are, nice middle class people, and there's no opportunities for others to get in. I'm employed by a YMCA in London, and the senior staff are employed who are Muslim people, and lots of other staff, professional staff, and I have that privilege of working with people. Of course, people are accommodated, young people are accommodated, who are of all different faiths as well as none, and it seems to me it is our job to get out there. I once saw a cartoon, and it showed somebody praying, saying, "God, I want to be a missionary." And a bubble was coming out of the sky, and it said, "Go to Liverpool." You know? And the challenge is, the challenge is every time we get on a bus or go in a restaurant or into whatever, I go to universities and colleges, and I go in and I see a table full of laughing young white people, and then you can see one person of a different colour on their own, on a table on their own, looking into a cold cup of tea. I think it is our responsibility to go out. I believe that growth does not reside in a place called comfortable. I think unless we're prepared to live on the edge, we just have white ghettos.
Okay. Have we got another question?
In a way, this is about urban issues, but also about Greenbelt. That have we lost in the church in Greenbelt and in other situations the sexiness of the urban issue, and that world issues have become the big thing? 20 years after Faith in the City, we've just had a new report. How are we engaging with that? Looking at the number of people here, emerging church is sexy, looking at the world is sexy. How I've learned about political issues and about faith and things like that is about learning first from the situation in which I'm in, and then that's helped me to understand outside. If people jump to looking at international issues without also understanding their context, are they seriously missing out? And is, I mean, I'm not criticising people here, because obviously you're here, but I mean, the size of this compared with how this might be 20 years ago is very different.
On this. One of the biggest steps in my life was when my faith stopped being personal only, because I used to be a right evangelical with a Bible in my jeans pocket all the time, and I saw purely a personal faith. One of the biggest steps in my life was when I believed and lived out a gospel which was about personal, social and cosmic. The cosmic is the big thing about the world, and I think to be holistic, I think we've got to work at all those, our local community, our national community, whatever, but also the world.
I think Pip said half what I was going to say, that I think that the global issues and our issues in our own neighborhoods are very much connected and one and the same. And that can be a really difficult thing to try to walk along that line, because there's only so much you can do as one person or with one organization or one church or whatever. And we have to be connected to each other. Otherwise, we're just little pockets of, oh, we're working in, you know, the city of Philadelphia, and then there's other people working over in Africa or in Iraq with different peace groups. And we have to be connected to each other and what we're doing and see the larger picture, as you were saying. A lot of the signs that you see at different protests around the U.S. these days with the war on terrorism and all these things, a lot of the signs say things about, you know, a bomb dropping in Iraq is like a bomb dropping on our schools in the inner city, and it's very much true. All of the budget in our country, in the United States, so much of it, I think over 50%, goes to the military, while our schools and healthcare and all those things just get cut and cut and cut and cut and cut. And that's why people are hurting so bad in the cities, because there's nothing there for them. And so these things are very, very, very much connected. So, yeah, I agree with you.
Those of us that are working in Liverpool are working out what our culture might be, because we are named a City of Culture elect. And if we ask ourselves what culture is, actually it's quite a hard question, because we don't usually look at our own culture and try and analyse ourselves. I think it's Tim Gorringe who says that culture is the interaction of people, place and story. And we need to, I think, re-engage with that interaction, to listen to the stories of the place, but also to understand our turf, and to walk the streets and to look and see and listen to what's going on. Usually we're very busy and we're very active and we're on a mission. But if we are able to listen and to look, then actually our culture is very nuanced. It's very deep. It's quite troubled. But it's operating on all sorts of different levels. And I think this conversation in Liverpool about culture is a very creative one, and one that should maybe not have to have City of Culture status to provoke.
I did say earlier that a part of what Urban Presence is about was recognition of the inner city areas within the wider church as a mission field, and it is a part of our work that has been singularly unsuccessful. There is an issue in that the bulk of the people live in the cities and the bulk of the Christians live in the suburbs. Not pointing the finger at anyone at all, but I think there's a real place in our discipleship to get the where of our service sorted out, not just the what.
If I could just add to that, that the command of Jesus was that we would be witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the uttermost corners. And if you look at the context in which it was said, it's progressive. And yes, the witnessing has to happen at home. It has to happen in Judea. It has to happen in Samaria. It has to happen to the uttermost corners. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's the same people doing it. And that's why partnership and relationship is very important. And sharing. Okay.
Have you got any advice for working with people who have got very used to receiving? I'm part of a group of Christians who are trying to work on or get into a local estate, a community there that's very disadvantaged but also very used to charity and free things, and it's just like a bottomless pit of need. And so they're used to, well, what else can you do for me? What else is for free? So it feels like we're trying to fill the need, but we're not getting any fruit from it. So we've done things like gardening privately and in public spaces and odd jobs and loads of different things, but it's kind of, well, is this what else is for free? Is this all there is? So we showed the World Cup on big screens trying to get to know people, and when we were publicising, people were like, well, will there be any free drinks? It's kind of, they're very, very used to benefits and help, but no engagement. Have you got any advice on how not to be disheartened?
I believe I believe in we've got to participate people and get people participated. I think it's so easy to do things. And the whole thing, I do so much training on that whole issue of getting people participating, because there seems to be like blinkered vision from so many individuals and groups and so on. And I'm blinkered, but I'm just trying to take them off, sort of thing. And I think to get people involved in, like at Greenbelt here, we talk about don't be a Greenbelt taker, become also a Greenbelt maker. So we want people to volunteer, to get involved and do something. And then Greenbelt grows in your heart a lot more. And it's same with people in the community. Often people have a toolbox with very few tools in the toolbox. And it seems to me that if we work with people and we help them to develop the skills and the awareness, the sensitivity, so they've got more tools in the toolbox. So when a life circumstances come, they can put their hand in and take it out. And I think those skills, which need a lot of working on, I work a lot on trying to get homeless people to participate in their own development. So they take risks from their own development. And it's the same principle skills as in counselling, where somebody comes with a problem, you don't say, oh, go and do this. You work it through as a facilitator. And equally so in community development, you work with the people. And I think you're talking about community development.
In Kensington, Philadelphia, we're really blessed to have a group called the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. And they were formed by the homeless mothers and families that were squatting in that Catholic church that helped spawn the community that I live in. And a good chunk of what they do is educate and bring up new leaders among the poor in their communities, and then also organize between poor folks in Kensington and poor folks in other areas of the country, the world, etc. And I think that that can be very, very key, is finding among the group folks who are natural leaders or are able to educate each other to really, you know, empower themselves and each other through that, because sometimes it takes listening and talking to and working through folks in the same predicament as you, and not just kind of getting it from, you know, folks that are coming in to help. I mean, it's kind of necessary for our development to be there with them, but for their development, sometimes they need each other more than they need us.
Just wondering whether there might be any scope for, and I know this is a big commitment, but moving into kind of employment help, or there are some fantastic church projects around. In fact, some of the best voluntary sector partners that the government's had in the New Deal programme have been church-based projects that have been working with people to help them into a job, because the best way out of the kind of dependency you describe is for people to get a job. I visited Peckham the other day, where I the Peckham Evangelical Church's Action Network, which has been a very, very effective contributor to the New Deal. And there is something, I think, about church-based projects working with the New Deal on employment. There's a commitment there and a passion there, which really seems to have been very, very effective in helping people get out of the kind of mindset that you've described and move on. Maybe that's an option.
That the main focus of our ministry is developing people. And so several of our staff have actually come in seeking help. And then they've been developed in their skills and so on, and they've gone to take advantage of college and so on. And some are our managers. And it's about giving people the skill to stand on their own two feet instead of just doing something for them.
It's something I think about the will to do something as well, isn't there? And quite often regeneration agencies have come in from outside of communities. They've given solutions that have not engaged local communities and fundamentally disempowered them socially. Now, there's been a lot of that, and so there's a lot to work against as you try to empower the whole of the community to respond to its own needs. And that's a lengthy process of change, which is both individual and social, I think. So, I mean, my advice is stick at it, because it does change as people begin to get the power to change their situation themselves.
Just to say quickly, it's something to do with moving from mission for or mission to, or even, dare I say it, mission at, to mission with. and working alongside people on issues that where you share a concern. So if people in the community are concerned about the amount of litter in the area, then try and work with and train. In Manchester, we've had several big missions come in over the years where hordes of young people have come in and have gone and tidied up an estate. And, I mean, some of my own family were involved in that, and it actually did them a lot of good. But how much benefit it did to that estate in terms of did it reinforce the dependency culture? Where that worked best was in areas where there was a healthy local Christian community there all the time, so it wasn't a hit-and-run thing, and so they were helping to raise their profile and lift that particular, what they were doing, just for that time.
Another question?
I think that links to what I wanted to ask about, which is the balance within churches between what ordinary congregation members do, most of whom are themselves dealing with a lot in their own families, their own work, and other things, and what the role of, as it were, project workers, professionals. A number of the panel and others are people who are, that is their key day job or day role, as it were, whatever the arrangements. I'm actually more from a rural area myself, where there's a lot less in the way of nice funding projects and things. And that lack of capacity in churches to actually, people may have a vision and have an idea of what they want to do, but when it comes to it, people have very little spare energy and capacity. And I wondered, how the panel felt about that. How much should church members be encouraged to do themselves, or how much is the answer to look at the latest funding program and get somebody in for 3 years to do something?
Okay. I'll have a go at that. I mean, I feel that churches that engage with their communities have come of age when they can turn down funding. So when they get to a point where they're a community that's engaged with their locality, rather than employing people to come in from outside and engage with their locality, then there is real transformation of what's possible. Now, I don't know what the panel have got to say about that, but
all I wanted to say was don't underestimate the small, because sometimes the agents of transformation are the smallest and maybe almost the invisible things. And I think we can be tempted by big projects with lots of money and professional workers and all that sort of stuff. And then the project can actually drive the vision rather than the vision drive the project. And at worst, the money drives it rather than the vision drives it. And my feeling is that it's much better to do something simple, well, and with something that's within your possibilities. Maybe it's only going to last a week or a month or whatever, and then it's going to stop and you're going to have a think about it. But it's much better to do that than to set up a huge project that is just not within your power, and it becomes disheartening. And when I think of our bread making, which is the most simple of exercises, it's really not difficult at all. The only people that we have that we struggle with bread making are experts. Everybody else can do it, from the smallest toddler to somebody with severe learning difficulties to the guy off the doorstep who's never made anything before in his life. And just to make bread and to give it to someone, that is such an empowering thing, but it's the simplest of things. And I believe that we set ourselves tasks that are too large. If I, in my faith journey, influence one other person in their faith journey and we flourish together, that's sufficient for a lifetime, And that's our calling of being faithful, is to just be faithful in the small. And the transformation, like the yeast in the bread, actually makes all sorts of extraordinary things happen, which perhaps aren't part of our agenda, our project outcomes, but are about the kingdom, which is a more wonderful thing.
That reminds me of the quote, small acts with great love. And I can't remember if that's Dorothy Day or Mother Teresa, but they probably both said it, let's be honest. All of us in my community attend different local congregations, and a few of us are a part of one called Circle of Hope. And the way that project-type things are undertaken is it comes from the down up. It's very grassroots in style in that we discuss a lot together on what's going on in the neighborhood that we're in. And then different folks decide, hey, I'm interested in doing this project. Anybody else? Then a few other people say, yeah, I want to do that. And then eventually they become a team, a mission team, and then figure out how that's possible to do. So nothing really gets too large for them to undertake in that it's from the body of folks that are going to be doing the work or coming up with what they're going to do, rather than having someone say, hey, we just got the money to do this thing. Do you guys want to try it? But nobody's... feels that that's their own to do necessarily, but someone's kind of put it on them and suggested it. And then also within my house itself, and there are many other communities that have been springing up around Philadelphia, the East Coast, and all across the rest of the country and other countries as well, of course. The work that we do is primarily out of our house. And so the budget doesn't necessarily need to be that big. And like you said, it's small acts with great love. So maybe in a day, my main work was going over to Mary's house and watching a movie with her because she was really lonely that day or something. You know, I do that all the time. And so, like you were saying, that's really just as valid as, you know, coming up with the statistics or for this great program that we did. You know, and it's good to have those programs. They're necessary as well. But... you know, just as necessary as hanging out with your neighbor.
Good, good.
I like it. I also think we need to have a bread-making tent at Greenbelt. Do you not think? So come and make some bread with us next year. The only thing I'll say is Martin Luther King did not say, I have a budget. He said, I have a dream. And it's exactly like you say, sometimes the focus for cash can move away from the mission. And again, illustrating Greenbelt, the equivalent of 4 staff and this whole festival is put together. How is it done? Because there are thousands and thousands of volunteers, and some of them are in this tent now, who give. And if that can be done in communities, small communities, bigger communities, hostels, in community centres, in churches even, where people are participating, fantastic.
Can I just put in a word in defence of budgets? I hope that Amber made the point that, you know, there's a place for the big projects as well, and I think that is important. And I mentioned the review that we're doing of what's called the third sector, and one of the key questions in that review is how can the government work better with faith-based organisations than we have done up to now. And we've recognised that, you know, we need to make some changes in order, but we've already seen some fantastic results from those projects, and I hope that they're going to carry on and develop further.
I mean, I think it is quite easy for the authenticity of a Christian response to a situation to be lost in the funding. We, in Bradford, built a new church, and a regeneration agency that gave us lots of money put us on the front cover of their annual report. And as I looked at the picture, I tried to get the angle how they'd managed to get the cross that was in front of the church out of the picture. And they'd airbrushed it out. So what I had to say is that this is the sign of our authenticity, and you've got to put it back in. And then we got our solicitor to write to them and say that this was our brand and we wanted it back on the front cover of their... So they actually did put it back on, and it was a sign of their learning that the authenticity of our position was actually very important to us. It was quite a tricky negotiation because they talked about then cutting the funding, but we worked that through. But authenticity and working with local communities in the way that we do is the thing that we have to bring to the context.
I like the statement you made about Martin Luther King, because we have lots of church leaders come to visit our center from within the UK and abroad, and they want to like was said before. You know, there are several churches now. God is stirring the heart of the church. I come from Nigeria, and the church was instrumental in bringing education and medicine and so many things to my country. And I, it seems to me that the church has lost its understanding of its role to its community. It's become more a talking shop. So we see this social action as something that we add on. Whereas when we look at the Gospels, we see Jesus feeding the poor, you know, the people that were hungry and healing the sick, and all these things were part of the gospel that Jesus preached. And so I suppose for us, the challenge, I mean, last year there was the Mercy Fest event in Liverpool where there were 10,000 people on the streets of Liverpool engaging with the community. And that's happening again this year. It's happened, you know, last week and it's happening next year. And where the church is beginning to wake up to its responsibility, that is not something we add on. Now, if we catch that vision, our center, you know, if we knew then what it would cost, we would have run a 100 miles from it, 1,000 miles from it. But what God gave us was a vision, and it's been faith building for us to walk with God in that vision and to see God glorified in it. So what I'm going to say is that, yeah, if we look at what we have, often it's 5 loaves and 2 fishes, whether people or resources. But then we've got God. And if he's in something, and if we can catch the heart of God in what we're doing, then God is able to deliver beyond our wildest dreams. And for us, our challenge has been really envisioning not just our church, but 200 church, other churches that we're part of the network within Liverpool, and saying, hey, what is our role? You know, why has God put us in this place with all these, you know, decaying structure around us? Let's rise up, let's seek the heart of God and see what God wants to do about it, and let's offer ourselves to him and see him turn it around through us.
I'm going back to the point the woman made over there a couple of points ago about working in an inner city estate. I teach in an inner city area, in inner city in the Midlands. And I think there's very much a feeling among educators that government policy is working against us. There doesn't seem to be a realisation that if you are working with people who are on the fringes of disaffection, that they are far harder to educate and to reach than your standard middle-class kids in suburbs. And yet we are no longer funded unequally. All the extra grants and things that we used to have are being taken away, and our funding is being cut repeatedly. To give a specific example, working with children in special needs, because of inclusion policy, as a class teacher, I'm supposed to teach children who are emotionally about 4 years old in a class of 8 and 9 year olds without support, and I can't do it. So what I'm saying is government policy is not working to help us, and there needs to be a realisation we don't want to feed the culture of dependency, but one of the best places to break it is in education. So why is that not being done?
Yes.
I think that's something that we put in the spending review.
I think perhaps it might be, yeah. I mean, I guess what I'd say is if you look at what's happened in achievement in primary and secondary schools since 1997, the biggest gains have been in those schools facing the biggest challenges. And to some extent, that's reflected government spending priorities. There has been extra help. I entirely take the point that there's plenty of scope for more. But, you know, from the point of view of this government, bridging those gaps, achievement gaps, is one of the most important things that we've got to do.
You're doing it by setting targets, lots and lots of targets, and you're fostering a culture of blame. So, like, if teachers aren't achieving because they've got loads of kids with special needs, you're then saying, right, we'll put that school in special measures, we'll make those teachers work even harder. And what those teachers actually need is support and encouragement and funding, not to be put in special measures.
I was at a school in my constituency yesterday where there was a culture of celebration. It wasn't a culture of blame. I mean, I'm not, you know, I entirely accept your characterization of what's happening locally, but that is certainly not what we're intending to do. And I think in the great majority of places, that isn't what's happening. However, you know, we are, over the next year, as we're planning our spending priorities for the coming 3 years, and we're doing it in a 10-year perspective, we are wanting to listen to what people are saying. I'm talking regularly to Alan Johnson about what's going to be in the education budget, and, you know, drop me a line, I'll be happy.
But teachers are being disempowered. They don't want teachers to think. They want us to train children. They don't want us to educate.
No, we do want teachers to think.
But
and think hard and
they
to
don't.
Educate.
Honestly, as a teacher, they do not want us to make children think. They want us to make children swallow what they think children should know.
Well, I certainly want teachers to teach children to think, and I'm confident my colleague Alan Johnson does as well.
But I'm just saying what it's like on the grassroots. That's what we feel.
I was going to say something in response to the last question about churches quite often being only going down the route of having their own projects so they can be in control. And there is an issue we found with Charisma trying to get the churches to get involved, and some haven't because they're suspicious because of the control thing. There are loads of opportunities for churches and for individual Christians to get involved with people. And one of those areas is in the whole area of education. In the city next to us in Salford, they have seen an incredible thing happen with, I think it's 5 schools that have come out of special measures in the last few years. And one of the things that's done that, well, it was, one has been prayer. They've got an incredible partnership going between churches, education and the council. And they've had church members actually committing time to go in and helping and getting more person hours available to those schools to help them. The target thing, but they've been trying to help them to meet those targets and to get extra resources and to support those teachers in practical ways and in personal ways and in spiritual ways. And they've seen, I think it's 4 to 5 schools come out of special measures in the last couple of years. So there are opportunities for individual Christians and for churches to get alongside. If we can maybe drop a bit of our own programs and create a bit of space and make ourselves available, there are opportunities in education and all sorts of other areas as well.
Okay, I think we've got time for one last question.
Thanks. Bob Holman, Glasgow. Statutory funding, latest figures show, is going increasingly to the large national voluntary societies, which got millions in reserve anyway, and decreasingly to small community projects. Why?
Yeah, I've seen a lady that I know in Moss Side who runs a work with young people, which she funds herself. I've seen her tearing up an application form because she couldn't understand it. Too many hoops to jump through. Too much short-termism. If you're going to get a decent thing going in an inner-city area, you're looking 10, 20 years minimum. 3 years just doesn't cut it. There is a need for a major rethink on the whole funding circus, and I use the word circus deliberately.
Can I just make the point about this review, because it is intended to be exactly that rethink, where the consultation runs up until the 30th of September. The questions are on the Treasury website. They include what more needs to be done to ensure that faith communities play their full part in the third sector, what specifically can government do to reduce unnecessary demands made on you and ensure that regulation helps rather than hinders, what prevents partnership working at local level. I mean, I think sticking up our hands and recognising, yet there are real hurdles for small organisations. We want to talk about what we can do to put things right, and I do, you know, would invite everybody to chip in responses. I suspect we may not get as big a response from faith organisations and small community organisations as we will get from those big organisations that you've mentioned, and I very much encourage people to send in some replies.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks to our panel. I'm going to give them a clap. And thanks also to our audience. And thanks for being with us. And I mean, I do encourage you to drop a note to Stephen about the spending review, because it responds to the number of responses. So if there is something about the number of locally working local community organisations responding to that on the website, then there will be some action, I think, and that would be good. Okay, so thank you very much. Thanks.